Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the story of three revolutionary American musicians and their role in the birth of jazz and how they wrote the soundtrack for the Civil Rights Revolution. Larry Tye joins us to talk about his book, The Jazz Men: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Hi, Larry. Good to see you again.
Great to be back with you, Mindy.
All right. So lots of books already written about these three jazz greats. So what angle did you want to take and why these three?
So I think you're being polite. The real question might be, what would a tone-deaf, older white guy have to say that hasn't been said in these 100 books before? And the answer is that I was distinctly not writing about their music. I was writing about these maestros off their bandstands. And I think that in addition to the brilliant musical legacies that we all know about, these three set the table for the Civil Rights Revolution in a way that was profound. But you shouldn't believe me on an important topic like that. A guy named Martin Luther King Jr. had this to say about what they did. He said, their joyful rhythms and the language of soul provided the counter melody for his music. King said in a speech that got very little attention at the time, he said, jazz speaks for life. Much of the power of our freedom movement in the U.S. has come from this music. It has strengthened us with its sweet rhythms when courage began to fail. It has calmed us with its rich harmonies when spirits were down. And I think he got it exactly right, and that's what I tried to look at when I went out and interviewed 250 people who knew or played with or were relatives of these three jazz greats.
Yeah. So you begin the book with a bit about each man's childhood. Let's start with Louis Armstrong and the Louis versus Louis. What did he like? Was he Louis or was he Louis?
So it depended what time you caught him. And sometimes it was Louis. Sometimes it was Louis. Sometimes it was Satchmo. He had more nicknames than anybody that I have ever seen. And I think he liked each one of them because it let him tell a story about where the name came from.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about his childhood.
So he grew up in a part of New Orleans that was so tough that it became known as the battlefield. And he grew up in poverty. He grew up not really knowing his father. His father was never around. And he learned on those streets of New Orleans, not just how to stay alive, but how to stand out. And learning how to blow a horn, a very basic horn, on the back of a rag wagon owned by a Jewish family named Karnofsky was the first time that he realized that he could actually make music and that that could change his life.
Yeah, the Karnofskys had a huge impact on him.
They did. He thought that watching old Jewish men pray was like listening to a lullaby. And he thought that this Jewish family, which had come from Eastern Europe and risen out of poverty, was a model for how he could rise out of poverty. And he was so attached to them that for the rest of his life, he wore a Star of David around his neck. And his third memoir, his last memoir, he dedicated, as he said it, to the Jewish family in New Orleans.
Mm. He got arrested at age 12, which put him in reform school. And he would later say it saved him.
It did. So if I can go back for a second, sure, to a guy who I wrote about earlier and you and I talked about on air, named Satchel Paige. And Satchel Paige grew up on equally rough streets in Mobile, Alabama, and he ended up in reform school. And he said famously that the 6.5 years he gave up his freedom by being in reform school taught him how to pitch and saved his life. Louis Armstrong, growing up at a similar time in a similar part of the country, had exactly the same experience. That on the one hand, he hated being in reform school, and on the other hand, he learned how to play a trumpet. He was designated to be the leader of the reform school band, and it changed his life. It probably kept him alive the same way being in reform school did Satchel Paige, and it taught him a skill that could make a difference such that more than a 100 years after his birth, you and I are here talking and celebrating his life.
Yeah. And interesting, it was not the trumpet that started his musical journey.
It wasn't. It was the old tin horn that he learned on that rag wagon. But he learned that one instrument could yield to another. And the one that he ended up settling on, it first was a cornet, and then it was a trumpet. And he could do things with that trumpet that, again, 100 years later, nobody's able to duplicate.
Yeah. All right. Count Basie, born William Basie. Tell us a little bit about William's young life.
So he grew up in a town called Red Bank, New Jersey, not far outside of New York. And the greatest motivation he had in Red Bank, New Jersey, was to find a way to get out of Red Bank, New Jersey. And he dreamed at one point of joining the circus, and that would have taken him out of town. And he ultimately realized that playing a piano was his ticket to getting the heck out of Red Bank and getting to where he wanted to be, with which was in New York, and it was the center of the music world. And he took as his model an incredible piano player named Fats Waller. And Fats Waller taught him how to make this piano sing in a way that he never imagined that it could do.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that. I love Fats Waller, and I did not know that they had that connection. So that was really interesting. And he was very close to his mother, Lillian.
So he was. He was not so close to his dad. He was very close to his mother. And one of his many motivations in trying to make success out of himself was to be able to send back money to his mother, which he ultimately did, so she would have an easier life. His parents grew up at the edges of the middle class in Black Red Bank, in a world that, even though it was well above the Mason-Dixon line, was every bit as segregated as the Deep South where Louis Armstrong grew up. And Count Basie, when he left Red Bank, he never looked back, and he never went back other than to visit his mother.
Mm. All right. Edward Ellington, Duke-like from the get-go. You write, few in the battlefield who grew up alongside little Louis Armstrong imagined that one day he would be the high priest of jazz. Nobody in his Red Bank parish dreamed that soft-spoken Willie Basie would make girls feel giddy, not to mention grow worthy of a regal title like Count. But Edward Kennedy Ellington of Washington, D.C. was something else. Not only did he display in his earliest days precisely the blend of dignity and conceit that would become hallmarks of his career, but he was dubbed Duke as early as middle school.
He was indeed. And he would walk down the staircase in their home in Washington, and he would walk down like he was a prince. And he would tell his cousins, applaud, applaud. And he saw himself as what he called the great grand duke. And he grew up in a world that was, in a way, halfway between Louis Armstrong's and Count Basie's. He was not in the Deep South, but he was not in the North. He was in a border area in the largest Black community in America and one of the proudest in Washington, D.C. And he took everything he had learned by growing up in a solidly middle-class house, and he thought that he was destined for greatness. And he proved that this wasn't just arrogance. It certainly was arrogance, but it wasn't just arrogance. It was a reflection of the fact that this guy had extraordinary talent and charm and poise, and all of America came to believe it.
Yeah. All three of them had doting mothers.
They did, and it wasn't accidental. All three had doting mothers, which was wonderful for them and gave them a sense of the potential they had, and all three had fathers who either played secondary roles or no roles at all in their lives. And I think that that was part of what gave them strength. They wanted to set a male model that they had never had when they were at home. And so they looked for surrogate fathers, and they wanted to be men that kids, their kids and other kids, could look up to.
Now, early in their careers, they were playing in places that didn't allow Black customers. And you talk about, you write about the Cotton Club. You say the stage design at this glamorous cabaret, right, could be called faux plantation. Tell us a little bit about that.
So it was. The Cotton Club was possibly the most elegant and famous jazz club in America in the middle of Harlem. It was a place that was, while it was in a black community, it was intended to attract whites from uptown to come and do their night of visiting the black community, but doing it in a way that the cynical and mobster owners of the Cotton Club knew would appeal to them. They could come there, they wouldn't have to worry about mixing with black clientele because blacks were given, if any table at all, the worst table in the place. And it was one of all the settings that Duke Ellington played at all across America, where he wouldn't have been admitted himself as a customer, and yet he was what drew white customers to the Cotton Club.
Yeah. And let's talk about his music. You write, in the middle of his Cotton Club stay in 1930, and in one of his first interviews, the 31-year-old Ellington talked about the music he was composing and playing. He knew the mutes and other inflections that gave his band a growling jungle sound were controversial with black columnists and intellectuals, but he believed to his core that it was uplifting rather than demeaning his race. There's a little controversy there with the music he played.
So there was controversy with his music. There was controversy with the Count and Louis Armstrong's music. They all were playing in an era where Jim Crow laws on segregation were in place by law in the South and by practice in the North. And they were trying to navigate this world. On the one hand, they were intent on not doing anything that would be demeaning to themselves or their race. And on the other hand, they were playing in a world where they had to be realistic about what they were able to do and what they weren't. And I think they showed that you could be an artist and an entertainer at the same time, that there was no contradiction. And I think that they not only ended up pushing back against those restrictions, but they played a vital role in Jim Crow falling the way it ultimately did in the 1960s.
And you say, well, different in many ways. The New York City and Kansas City cabarets each played a seminal role in the history of jazz and therefore America. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So in Kansas City, which is where Count Basie was getting his start, it was the style known as Kansas City swing. And there was nobody more swinging than Count Basie. And he went there and he was playing in a joint that I'm going to do a talk at in a couple weeks. It was called the Reno Club. And it was smoky and there was no room for anything really people to move around, but it was a place where great music resonated. And the music was never better than when Count Basie was in there tinkling his ivory keyboards. And people, it was said that when you listen to Count Basie, if your foot wasn't tapping, you ought to go see a doctor because there was something wrong with you. He had a way to make people not just sing along, but to make them want to move and get up and dance. And that was true of all three of these guys. They had a way of making you want to move.
And not only were your toes tapping, but talk about Count Basie's toes. The band would be looking to him like the way his toes would move when he played.
Exactly. They called it your tell. And some people, it was the way they moved their lips or the way that their eyes sort of gave a clue to their orchestra that something was going on. With Count Basie, it was his toes. And his bandmates knew to look at them, and they could tell when it was going to swing, when it was going to slow down. Everything about his tell was in his toes.
All right, talk about Lewis and scatting. He was pretty famous for that kind of heebie-jeebies, right?
He was. So scatting was when he was saying things that sounded like nonsensical words, and they were. But it was a way of sort of giving new movement to the music. It was making up words the same way he was making up notes. And it became one of his elemental aspects. And he was so famous for the scatting he did, people thought he invented this whole concept of making up these nonsense words. But like many things, he didn't make it up, but he was the one who took it to new heights and therefore was credited as being the founder of scatting.
And as one might imagine, touring could be dangerous, especially in the South. And they got help from people might remember the Negro Motorist Green Book, which people have talked about, and then later the Pullman trains. But talk about the danger that they faced when they were touring.
Sure. So if we can talk about it in the form of a story about the Pullman Porters.
Yeah.
The when you went south in those days, when Ellington Armstrong Basie or any other black entertainer went south, going into the wrong, trying to take get a room at the wrong hotel or going into the wrong restaurant could not only get you beat up, it could put you at the end of a hangman's noose. The Jim Crow restrictions were so tight. And so not wanting to face the anxiety of whether they could find a place to eat or to sleep at night, Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, in the early days, trusted word of mouth. They would call the local barber or undertaker or somebody in the community where they were going to, and they could say, where is a black household that puts up itinerant entertainers like us, and where can we safely go? And there became a network long before there was a green book that passed among these musicians and other entertainers and where it was safe. But when they were making enough money in their later years, they realized they could do something magical. They could rent these elegant Pullman sleeping cars. They could drive to a community like Atlanta. And at night, when they went off to do their performances, they paid for the trains to pull off the tracks. And at the end of their concert at night, they knew they could go back to that sidecar Pullman train, and they would have these incredible black Pullman porters give them an amazing meal, give them a bed that was as elegant as any hotel. And in return, what guys like Ellington did was they performed a midnight jam session in the closed capsule of the Pullman sleeping car for the Pullman porters. And it was the Pullman porters that I interviewed for an earlier book who told me, who made me promise that someday I would write a book on their three favorite passengers, three guys named Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and Louis Satchmo Armstrong.
We're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And we'll talk more after a quick break. Listening to The Point, we're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Before the break, we were talking about the Pullman Porters. That's sort of a whole story in itself. That was a pretty good job for these guys.
It was not just a good job. It was the best job that a black man could get from the end of slavery for the 100 years that Pullman was the most elegant way to get across country, from the 100 years from the 1860s to the 1960s. And these black men were hired by George Pullman because he knew that people who had essentially earned their PhDs in servitude by being slaves would be the perfect servants for his Pullman cars. They would, at night, if you needed your clothes pressed, they would do that. If you needed your shoes shined, they would do that. If you needed somebody who wouldn't tell stories about whose compartment the white passengers had ended up in on these long trips across country, they would keep their mouths zipped. And they were amazing because during the time they were working on these sleeping cars, they also realized that they could more than double their salary if they were good enough in taking care of their white passengers. They earned more in tips than they did in salary. They made more than any black man could earn in those years. And they got to see America in the way that no black men could do during that era of Jim Crow. And it is not accidental that somebody like Michelle Obama happens to be the great granddaughter of a Pullman porter. If you looked at any prominent African American from that era, from politics to science to commerce, the chances that they had a father or a grandfather or an uncle who was a Pullman porter were astounding.
We talked touched on a little bit about the criticism that these three came under for their music, and Louis Armstrong seemed to come under the most criticism. Talk a little bit about his song "When It's Sleepy Time Down South" and the controversy over that.
So that song seemed to glamorize the whole plantation life, the life during slavery, and it was a song about how it was all a life of joy for not just whites, but for blacks in that era. And that was a song that partly Louis Armstrong played and sang tongue in cheek, and partly it was a reflection of what life truly had been like in that era of Jim Crow. So it was easy to point the finger in Louis Armstrong. Here was this guy who was hamming it up on stage. He was pulling out an endless strings of handkerchiefs when he was performing, wiping his brow, and people could easily look at that and say, this is somebody who's an Uncle Tom. This is somebody who young blacks would say it was embarrassing to them. But everybody who said that, especially people who got to know him, over time seemed to change their mind. They changed their mind because they realized he was performing his trumpet solos in his scat singing with such elegance that he was showing the heights that blacks could rise to in terms of being artists. He was taking his music into all white settings in a way that people like Martin Luther King realized was paving the way for blacks and whites to learn to come together. He was doing things as an artist that set him apart from any other jazz musician of his era, and made it easier not just for jazz men who followed him, but for blacks in any format that followed him to come and penetrate the barriers of Jim Crow America.
You begin the chapter on Sidemen with, "There's a secret in the jungle that every creature knows. The lion's got no power without all the other cats." This is interesting to look at the stories of the relationship that these three guys had with their sidemen and sidewomen, but we'll get to that.
Yes. So the sidemen were partly people that the three musicians that we're talking about would pay tribute to. They realized how important they were to their success, to making the bands that they played with as extraordinary as they were. But they also, and especially Duke Ellington, exploited their sidemen. They didn't always credit them for the songs they had helped write. They didn't give them, while they paid them decent salaries, they never made nearly as much as the band leaders did. And it was a push and pull kind of relationship. They couldn't get along without the sidemen, but Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie rightfully felt that they did extraordinary things for the careers of their sidemen. They helped make them successes, and they sometimes acknowledge that.
Yeah. And talk a little about your thoughts on, obviously these weren't the only big band folks we had. We had a lot of big bands at that time. And how about stealing sidemen, trying to be stolen from other bands? That happened, right?
So it happened endlessly back and forth. Ellington was famous for stealing sidemen of anybody from Cab Calloway to Armstrong and Basie, and yet he had his sidemen in return stolen. All the black band leaders of that era knew one another, they loved one another, and they weren't beyond stealing from one another.
Mm-hmm. Of the sidemen, do any of them stand out to you? I mean, looking at some of the relationships, some were, some were really, really close. They were very, very close to some of their sidemen.
So they were. So each of these band leaders had a sideman that they were especially close to and that they could trust to be the sort of informal leaders of the band. When you were Duke Ellington and you were out there worrying about where the next gig was going to be and you were composing and arranging music, you needed somebody like Harry Carney, his favorite of his sidemen, to be getting the pulse of what was going on in the band, to be knowing when trouble was brewing, and importantly with Ellington, when his sidemen in the early days were taking ramshackle buses across the country, Ellington and Harry Carney were whizzing across and meeting them at various places, going in Ellington's private, elegant cars. And he loved his sidemen, but he didn't necessarily want to suffer some of the difficult times just getting to places that his sidemen did.
And then there were the side women, and really scary times touring as a Black man, but as a Black woman, even scarier.
So it was. So as a Black woman in that era, there were a couple problems. One problem was that generally the jazz greats that we think of among women from that era were often relegated to the role of vocalists. They were extraordinary vocalists. People like the Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday, but it was very difficult to break in as a woman instrumentalist. It was even tougher to break in as a woman band leader. And Black women had two sets of indignities that they had to deal with. They had to deal with the same racist Jim Crow laws that Black men did, plus with all the gender stereotypes. And even Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, who treated their side women better than just about anybody, were chauvinists, and women like Billie Holiday called them out on that repeatedly.
Yeah. And you tell a story in the book, I think it was Mary Lou Williams, who there was some concern that she might be kidnapped, right? Somebody would pay to $50 to, you know, to bring her to his farm. You're right. I'm not saying who was saying this. I had heard many tales about Black women being kidnapped and taken to Mississippi across state lines out of the reach of Tennessee authorities. And when their parents had gone to get them, they were shot at the gate.
So those kinds of stories, you heard all the women telling those kinds of stories. And the idea of having to worry about whether your voice was going to be tuned up for the next gig and whether you were going to help Duke Ellington write the song the way you wanted to, at the same time you were worried about being kidnapped. Can you imagine that? Mm. Just the tense environment that they were with, the indignities that they suffered, and the way they managed to come out on stage looking like nothing was wrong and performing with an extraordinary poise and elegance.
Yeah. All right. Talk about mobster ties. We got some mobster ties with all three of these guys.
So we do. So Louis Armstrong had two managers who got him into trouble and who clearly didn't know in the early days just how great he was. And he was looking around desperately for the right manager, and he ended up coming across a guy named Joe Glazer, who was one of the strongest and most notorious underworld characters, who modeled himself on Al Capone in Chicago, and who ran dive bars, and who gambled, and who probably ran a string of prostitutes that he proudly talked about anytime anybody would ask him about them. And he understood Louis Armstrong. He understood that you needed a tough guy to take care of Louis in a tough environment like Chicago. He knew that Louis Armstrong could go anywhere he wanted to in terms of his talent and his success. And he told Louis Armstrong, you just worry about what you're doing on stage. I will take care of everything behind the scenes. And he did. He ended up taking more money than he probably should have from Louis, but Armstrong and Glazer call themselves brothers, and they really acted like it.
Yeah. And then just thinking, there was a lot of managers, too many to mention, but a few that stood out to me. Another one was Duke's manager, Irving Mills. Tell us a little bit about Irving Mills.
So Irving Mills shared a lot of the characteristics of Joe Glazer. Both were white guys who knew how to play tough when they had to, and both were not accidentally Jewish. All three of these band leaders had Jewish managers at one point. And it was partly because Blacks and Jews both had an extraordinary heritage of storytelling. Both were outsiders in an America that was racist and anti-Semitic in those years. And the Black-Jewish alliance of the last century was in evidence nowhere more than it was in the world of jazz and music. So all three not only had Jewish managers, they had Jewish bandmates, and they had Jewish friends. And what we had talked about earlier with Louis Armstrong wearing a Star of David around his neck for his whole life, similar kinds of warm relationships in this Black Jewish alliance existed for Ellington and Basie as well. And I think, maybe naively, but I think it's a model that could serve as a model today where the Black Jewish ties have been so frayed in our world of today.
Yeah. I talk a little bit about accounts manager Henry Hammond.
Yes. So Hammond, John Hammond, was somebody who was listening to his radio, driving around New York, his car radio, and he heard from this little Reno club in Kansas City, he heard a broadcast of this guy who he thought was spectacular. He had never heard of a guy named William Count Basie, but he got on a plane and headed out to Kansas City and made him an offer. He said, basically, I can take you out of this rat hole, the Reno club, and I can make you a star. And he made that promise, and he kept that promise. And he was the guy who discovered Count Basie and helped bring him to America.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, these managers, they needed them. Like you talk with, when you talk about Joe Glaeser, that's a lot to think about. You're trying to do your music, you're managing your band, you're worrying about your safety and your travels and, you know, who's getting paid, who's not. It's a lot going on. I mean, it was probably a big relief to have these guys helping them with their careers.
So it was an extraordinary relief. And the idea that you were worried about making music and doing all the things it took to keep a band together, knowing that you had these managers who would take care of the business side of things, you were willing to turn over all kinds of authority to them and all kinds of money. Mm-hmm. And anybody who ever managed Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie themselves became rich at the same time they were making these three band leaders rich in a way that Blacks of that era only dreamed about.
We're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. We'll talk more after a break. Listening to The Point, we're talking with Larry Tye. His new book is The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Let's talk a little bit about the women in their lives. We talked a little bit, they were all had doting moms, but they also had a lot of other women in there between wives and mistresses. I was finding it hard to keep them all straight.
So when you take on characters like these, I had written books before on people who were my heroes when I started out, people like Bobby Kennedy and Satchel Paige and Superman. And when you start out with these characters who you adore and idolize, it is only when you start digging deeper you realize there are other sides of their personalities and that it's not all a rosy picture. And one other side of all three of the maestros that I was writing about is their lives outside of their marriages. All of them had mistresses, none more than Duke Ellington. All of them had wives who they adored, a little less in Ellington's case than the others, and all of them managed somehow to keep all of this together. Louis Armstrong was having affairs with women left and right, and yet his wife stayed with him through all of them because she knew that at the end of the day, he always came back to her. Count Basie's wife actually walked out on him at various points, but she ended up coming back because he promised he would never do it again. And I think it was partly a function of life on the road. There were a million temptations, and they were away from their families as many as 300 of 365 days a year. But it was also that these people were at the height of their profession and at the height of celebrity in America, and they thought they could get away with anything, and they tested those limits repeatedly. And one of my favorite experiences in researching this book was when Duke Ellington's granddaughter, Mercedes Ellington, took me on a tour of throughout Harlem of everywhere that Duke had played, everywhere he had lived, and everywhere he had stashed a mistress. And I can tell you that that last category was more stops than anything. And we ended up at an amazing place called Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. And it was amazing because Duke was buried next to the favorite of his mistresses. And it was amazing because he was buried across the street from Miles Davis and down the hill from all these amazing jazz greats. And I'm convinced, Mindy, if you and I were to do a trip to Woodlawn Cemetery at midnight some night, we would hear an extraordinary jam session of Miles Davis, of Duke Ellington, and of all of his bandmates.
Yeah. One of the other interesting stories of Duke is his son, and Ruth. Tell us a little story. They were treated very differently, Mercer versus Ruth. Tell us a little bit about their histories.
Sure. So Mercer was Duke's son. He was having what looked like a successful career being a DJ and doing things in the world of radio. And one day Duke called him and said, "I'm firing my manager. You've got to come and manage the band." So he came and managed the band. He played with the band, and he suffered Duke's perpetual critiquing of everything that he did. He never felt like he could measure up. And it was a really difficult thing living in the shadow of a great performer like Duke Ellington and one who was so critical. But as critical as Duke was of his son, he was incredibly adoring and nurturing and at times overweeningly supportive of his sister, Ruth. And his sister was 16 years younger than him. And there were rumors, which I partly believe, that Ruth might not have been Duke's sister, that she could have been his daughter. Mm-hmm. And the idea of having a child out of wedlock at that time was so unacceptable that Duke's overprotective mother, it was said, called her granddaughter her daughter, because that made it easier for Duke not to suffer rebuke for having a child out of wedlock.
Yeah. And he certainly was very supportive of Ruth for her life, right? I mean, he took good care of Ruth and his mother.
He did indeed. Yeah. Yes. No, he did.
They also had their share of what you call cravings and dependencies.
They did. So let's just take one of them to start with. Let's take Count Basie. When Count Basie pulled into a new city where they were about to do a concert, before he would warm up the band or before he would do anything for the work that he was there to do, he would find out where the closest racetrack was, and he would zip off in a taxi cab to put bets down, generally losing bets, and bets that at times made it impossible for him to meet payroll with a band. But he had an addiction to the ponies. Louis Armstrong had a different kind of addiction. Just about every day of his adult life, he lit up a marijuana cigarette and he smoked what he called gauge, or that good blank, a word that we can't say on the air, but he loved marijuana and he thought it shouldn't be illegal and he thought it fine-tuned his sensibilities. Duke Ellington had a different kind of superstition. His superstitions became a different kind of addiction for him. He wouldn't use anything that was the color brown because brown suggested the earth and being buried in the earth. He wouldn't accept any shoes as a gift from his bandmates or his friend because they suggested, again, the ground and being buried. And somehow he worried either that the shoes would be an omen for his friends and his bandmates walking away from him, or that they would suggest him being close to death. It was crazy, the suspicion, the superstitions, and the addictions these guys had, and yet they managed to overcome them and perform in a way that nobody else had before them.
Yeah, and the Duke probably the most superstitious. I really like the fact that he preferred to make decisions, sign contracts, or open gigs on Friday the 13th. Most people would say unlucky. Not him.
Exactly. To Duke, because he had once signed one of his best contracts on that date, it became a sign of luck and not of ill will or ill luck.
And here we talk about them all having mistresses and all having, you know, some sort of, as you call, cravings and dependencies. They all believed in God, prayed daily, and read the Bible.
They did. So they all realized that one of the sources of their inspiration for their musical lives was the churches they had gone to, generally gospel churches or Pentecostal churches, when they were young. And they realized that music from the church and the faith from the church, they all came from families where their mothers were devoutly religious. And even though they had strange ways of showing it by breaking half of the Ten Commandments, they all had a fealty to the church for the rest of their lives.
How were they received overseas versus how they were treated in America?
They were received well enough overseas, especially in the early days when they were performing in places like London and in Paris, that at times all three of them thought about maybe never coming back home. The critics were more receptive to them overseas, and the audiences were bigger and louder and more adoring than in America. But they all were patriotic Americans, and all three of them ended up performing as unofficial ambassadors when they went overseas. The State Department actually underwrote their travels and realized that at a time when we were in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and the Soviets were pointing the finger at racism in America, they could undermine those kinds of charges by sending these three talented Black men to perform behind the Iron Curtain and across the world, making a case that whatever racial problems America had, they were redressing, and that they were proud of their, that we were proud of our Black artists. Mm-hmm. And while they were critical at home of America's racism, overseas, they were ultimately patriotic Americans.
One of the, we didn't talk about the Count's wife, Catherine, and their daughter, Diane. And it was Catherine who got the Count to move. Was it the Bahamas? I forgot what island where they moved to.
So they did move to the Bahamas. She was tired of life in the big city in New York where they lived. She was tired of the Count's traveling so much and carousing. So they went on vacation to the Bahamas. She fell in love with it. He bought her an amazing estate there, and she lived out the rest of the years there. And the Count came home as often as he could, partly because he wanted to be with his wife, Catherine, and partly because they had a daughter who was seriously disabled, Diane, and he was a doting father with Diane.
Mm, yeah, he sure was. What has been the reaction so far to the book?
So the reaction has been, my favorite reaction has been from some of the musicians who were extraordinary in giving up their time to me, people like Wynton Marsalis and Sonny Rollins and the Gary Burton, who said that they learned things from this book. They knew these musicians and idolized them and tried to draw strength from them. But they said this other side of their lives off the bandstand, and especially their role in helping set the table for the civil rights revolution, were things that they didn't know. And it made them proud as Black musicians today to know the heritage that jazz wasn't just a popular music form, but it was the all-American music form, and it helped transform America.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the research, and some. I'm sure some of this stuff must have come as a surprise to you, and some of the differences they made. I'm trying to remember which one was like, they wanted somebody to come in and they didn't allow Blacks, and it was like they were insistent, right? No, you're going to let them in.
They were repeatedly insistent. They actually signed contracts later in their careers when they had the clout to do this, saying that unless the audience was integrated, they wouldn't play at these places. Mm-hmm. And they did. I found stories. So every time I write a book, the first reaction I get when I interview people is, you're 20 years too late and nobody's around to tell the story. And what you realize is it just means you have to look harder. And it may mean that you have to look at nursing homes rather than just sort of going to places to watch people perform. I found hundreds of people who knew intimately these three musicians, who had played with them, who were their friends or relatives, and who knew stories about them that they'd never been asked before, and that they were incredibly obliging in sitting down and telling me. And I talked to about 250 people in total, and just about every one of them was a joy, because I was hearing not just stories about these three musicians, but stories about a rip-roaring, toe-tapping life in the last century that made it come alive again to me.
You talked about each had a theme song, and early on in their careers. Talk about the theme song each of them had and if that held true through their career.
So each of them had a theme song that they started with that changed over the course of their career. In the early days with Count Basie, for instance, it was songs about the places that he was playing at. It was Jumping at the Woodside. It was 1 o'clock Jump. It was these songs that were only about the music and about the toe tapping that they were doing. Later in his career, his song that he was most closely identified was Fly Me to the Moon. And he was identified with it because astronauts actually took this song to the moon. And in the tapes that they had when they were bored up during their circling of the earth, they were listening to Count Basie's music. And each of them, and later in his career, Louis Armstrong's theme song, and the one that he was most noted for, was Hello Dolly. And it was because he was there on Broadway making Hello Dolly the hit that it was. And their songs indicated the transformation that they were making in their lives. And they were much more limited in the early days. And in the later days, they became songs that all of America knew and all of America swung to. In Duke Ellington's case, the song that I can put on today and that still makes my toes taps is Take the A-Train. And it was a story about how he was trying to give directions on how to find him to his young protege, who was the Billy Strayhorn, and he was giving him directions on how to make it to that part of New York, and he said, take the A train. And Strayhorn and Ellington worked out a tune that became his signature.
What is it you hope people take away from the book?
It is that in order to understand the history of race in America, we don't want to do it through some painful process of sitting down and reading five history books, that we can look at things like the Negro League baseball players with Satchel Paige and the jazz music of the last century, and we can see a story that goes beyond a story about music. It's a story about America at its toe-tapping best, but at its racially racist worst. And I think that every time I want people, when they hear a jazz song, to think about all the history that that conjures up.
You're going to be at Sturgis Library May 9th. May 10th, you're going to be at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation. May 11th, Kituat Federated Church. And we're going to have a link with all of that at our website, capeandislands.org. The book is The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Larry Tye, as always, thanks so much for being with us and for writing the book.
As always, it was wonderful to be with you. Thank you, Mindy.